Thank you, everyone, for coming so early in the morning. Hopefully it hasn't been too much of a struggle and you've had time to have coffee and engage your brain. As you would know, the Reserve Bank of Australia publishes its updated forecast once a quarter in the Statement on Monetary Policy. The document's 75-odd pages, so we talk about all the information that we've used to synthesise the narrative that we have in the Outlook chapter and the overview, and we also publish our forecasts. Given that this is a forecasting conference, I'm going to focus on the forecasting part of the statement, so that obviously means I'm leaving a huge amount of material out, so I'm more than happy to answer questions on any of the rest of the statement. But I think in the interest of the segue to the panel, maybe focusing on the forecasts, and in particular the uncertainties we have around the forecasts and how we should weigh those things together, I think that would be most productive. So I'm just going to say a few very brief words about the international economy, but I'm actually going to spend much more time talking about the domestic economy because I think our views on the domestic economy have probably shifted and that's probably of more interest. But basically, we think in terms of major trading partner growth, so the weights that we have on this means that we put much more weight on places like China because we do a lot of trade with China than the sorts of forecasts you might see from the IMF. So often what actually gets discussed in the press is the IMF forecast, and so the numbers might look a little bit different. But for quite a long time, we've been expecting that major trading partner growth will slow. And I think the data that we've had, particularly in the second half of 2018, has confirmed that. There's a whole range of reasons for this. So if you're looking at places like China, they put in place a whole lot of policies to try and get the financial stability risks contained, and that's quite clearly led to some slowing in the Chinese economy. But there's also a whole range of much more structural factors operating in China. So there's demographics, there's the fact that emerging economies go from having very, very high rates of productivity because they're benefiting from moving people from low productivity areas of the economy to high productivity areas of the economy. And as time goes by, it's quite natural for those forces to diminish. So those sorts of things are sitting underneath those forecasts as well. I guess what has changed is probably our assessment of the balance of risks around this forecast. So over the past 3 months, 6 months, it does seem to have been an increase in the downside risks. So some of these are around things like the trade tensions between China and the United States. So that's an evolving story. It's very hard to know exactly how to assess them because we don't actually know what parameters we're dealing with because the negotiations on the trade policy haven't been completed. But because China is such a big part of this story, uncertainty about the growth outlook for China is also quite important. As I mentioned, there's a whole range of policy activity in China, so they've been trying to manage the risks around their financial sector that has led to a slowing in credit growth, in particular to the private sector. They've put in place some targeted fiscal and monetary policy to try and stimulate some of the areas of the economy that have slowed the most. And so there's a real question about how that mix of policies is going to play out and how the authorities are going to react if growth really does slow a lot more than what they're hoping. So that's just a general uncertainty. We really just don't know what's going to happen. We put a lot of effort into analysing China and developments in China because it is so important for us. I'm sure the panel will be able to elaborate on some of these international risks, but I thought it would be more useful to talk about the uncertainties in the domestic economy that we've highlighted in the statement. So I think if I had to summarise it in one word, I've summarised it in three words, really. So for a long time, we've been talking about how the outlook for growth is affected by uncertainty about the outlook for consumption. I'm going to talk about these in more detail. Some of the uncertainty about the outlook for consumption really comes down to uncertainty about the trajectory for household disposable income. And one of the key factors in there is how the labour market's going to evolve. So I'll talk a little bit about the labour market as well. And I think over the past 3 months, it would be hard to ignore the fact that conditions in housing markets, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, have changed quite a bit. And so another question for us is, well, how do developments in housing markets, as we've seen them play out, affect growth forecasts and our forecasts for inflation? So I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I mentioned that we have been referring to uncertainty about consumption for quite a long time as one of the key factors sitting underneath our forecasts. So you can see from the top panel of this graph that the reason that we've been saying that is that consumption growth has actually exceeded household disposable income growth for quite a long time. So at a very basic level, this isn't a sustainable outcome. So we can't keep doing this forever. So there are, you know, in summary, you can think of that being resolved in one of two ways. One is that household disposable income growth picks up, and therefore you have them growing at more similar rates. The other alternative is that households think about, well, I thought my income growth was going to pick up, so I was prepared to maintain my consumption, so smooth my consumption over time, lower my saving rate a little bit because I know that at some point in the future my income growth is going to pick up. So this is the permanent income hypothesis, in case, I hope that's on the curriculum for the HSE. And so the question then is, well, what happens if households go, well, actually now I've seen 2 or 3 years of low income growth and I'm not feeling so confident that my income growth is going to pick up the way I thought it was. So that's a situation where they might start making the adjustment by lowering their consumption growth. So that's been a risk for quite some time because this discrepancy between consumption and income growth has been there for some time. And you can see the consequence, which is really just an identity, is that the household saving ratio has been declining. So I'll get onto the labour market in a minute, but you can see how important developments in the labour market are for understanding or making an assessment of which of those two outcomes is most likely. So if we think that the labour market prospects are quite positive and wage growth will pick up, which is our central forecast, that explanation that household disposable income growth will pick up to sort of be more similar to consumption growth is actually quite reasonable. But we're always looking for signs that maybe the alternative is going to be the case. So we spend quite a bit of time in the statement talking about consumption for that reason. But also after the day after the December board meeting, we got the September quarter national accounts. And so you can see from the blue bars, there's lots of information on this graph, but start with the blue bars. This is the quarterly growth rate in consumption. So in the September quarter, quarterly consumption growth was quite low, and I think it's fair to say that most people were surprised by how low consumption growth was. So then our question is, well, how much signal do we take from that? Do we kind of go, oh, gee, this is a sign that consumption growth is going to be low in an ongoing sense, or is there a bit of noise, a bit of measurement issues in there? So one reason to, I guess, give a little bit of weight to the possibility that there's some noise is you can see that the last run of the blue bars have been quite jagged, so they've been quite volatile. So strong quarter, weak quarter, strong quarter, weak quarter. That makes you go, ooh, well, maybe this is a part of the strong quarter, weak quarter pattern, so maybe we don't want to put too much weight onto it. The other thing that happened was that we got fairly significant revisions to consumption growth. So you can see that in the comparison between the pink line, which is what we thought consumption growth was when we had the June quarter national accounts, and the blue line, or the navy blue line, that's what we think consumption, or that's what the ABS tells us that consumption growth has been. So what we had thought consumption, so that's actually a revision of about 0.2 percentage points in year-ended terms to consumption growth over the last 2 or 3 years. So in combination, and we have actually got another piece of information since then. So we have retail sales information for the December quarter. And so I think it's fair to say that the retail sales numbers for the December quarter were also on the weak side. So I guess from the perspective of people who haven't been in the forecasting game, this is where the art comes in. So you have to make a decision about how much information do you take from all the pieces. And what we decided was that we should take quite a bit more signal from this than perhaps we have in the past, and we've actually made a downward revision to the consumption profile. In the near term, that's pretty much a function of what we saw in the December quarter retail sales and what we saw in the September quarter national accounts. But further out, so going out to sort of 2020, we've basically made an assessment that the medium-term growth path for consumption is about a quarter of a percentage point lower than what we had published in the previous statement. And that is largely a function of this revision to history. So turning to the labour market, so really the single most important determinant of people's consumption decisions is their income growth and how they expect their income growth to evolve. If we're talking about the balance of risk on the forecast, actually the thing that really has surprised us on the upside over 2018 was the labour market. So it was much stronger than we expected. Employment growth was stronger than we had expected. The unemployment rate came down by more than what we had expected. And we expect that that strength in the labour market will continue. So why do we feel so confident about the labour market? We have information from forward-looking indicators. So we have information about how firms are planning their hiring. We have information about what vacancies they've posted. So that gives you information about how strong the labour market's likely to be over the next 3 to 6 months. And GDP growth is actually at or a bit above potential. So we're expecting that the spare capacity in the economy will continue to be will continue to diminish over this forecast period. And so in that situation, you would expect employment growth to be pretty strong and for the unemployment rate to decline. So this graph has a forecast of which sort of summarises that view, which is that the unemployment rate will continue to decline. I'd have to say this is actually a pretty gradual decline. So the unemployment rate's already 5% and we have it going down to 4.75% over a number of years. So there's the fan chart gives you some idea of what sort of uncertainty or statistical uncertainty we've had in the past based on forecast errors we've made in the past. So you can see that, you know, this is not a precise forecast. In a world where we think that the labour market is going to continue to tighten, we feel reasonably confident about our forecast that wage growth will pick up gradually. So some of that confidence comes from the fact that there's quite a bit of evidence that wage growth has already started to pick up. I don't want to overstate what that looks like, but I think we do feel reasonably confident that we've hit a bit of a turning point. So in this graph, we have the wage price index, which is one of our one of the measures that we use to look at wages. It looks at a constant quality basket of jobs, so it tries to strip out a whole lot of things like what if some industries are growing faster than other industries. It tries to keep the composition fixed. And you can see from this graph that there does seem to have been a bit of a turning point already. We also have researchers who have been able to get access to the micro-level data at the ABS, and so in conjunction with the ABS, they've looked at the individual jobs and the wage behaviour of the individual jobs. And what that suggests is that the wage increases that people are getting aren't changing a lot, but the frequency with which people are getting wage increases has gone up. And another way of saying that is that over this recent period, or even since the global financial crisis, quite a lot of people have experienced wage freezes. And the proportion of the labour force that's experiencing a wage freeze is declining. So we're not going back to the world that we had before the GFC, where there were sectors of the economy where wage growth was, you know, in the fours and the fives. That's not what's happening, but we are seeing that the zeros are dropping out, and so the overall aggregate wage growth is picking up. And we think that if the labour market continues to tighten, that we have reasonable expectations that this sort of gradual pickup will continue. And so that underpins household income growth, which underpins the forecast or the confidence that the consumption growth will hold up, if you like. The housing market. So I think there's all sorts of ways to make this point. So what I have here is house price growth by houses and apartments for the four main capital cities. You can see that particularly for Sydney and Melbourne, housing prices have been falling. You can debate how important or how much information you should take out of the December and January numbers, because we know that there's not a lot of activity in housing markets in December and January, so maybe some of the numbers aren't going to be as accurate as some of the numbers prior to that. But you really, the bottom line is that housing prices are falling. At the same time, you can see that Perth, for example, which had falling housing prices, they looked like they'd leveling out a bit. They've started to fall again, it seems. And we have a lot of information about activity in housing markets, which I think you have to take in conjunction with these price data. So auction clearance rates and the number of auctions had been falling through the second half of last year. And of particular interest is housing turnover. So this is measures of... So CoreLogic produces measures of housing turnover, and housing turnover is as low as it's been since the early 1990s. And I'll talk a little bit more about why turnover is particularly relevant. But basically, if houses aren't turning over, that tends to be related to situations where house prices are falling or the growth rate is declining. And so clearly, something has changed about the housing market. So the question for us is, so there's a whole range of different ways that affects the economy. I'm just going to talk about the macroeconomic effects. There's also obviously a whole range of financial stability questions that you want to ask as well. Probably the best place to ask those questions is at a presentation on the financial stability review. Depending on what they are, I can give them a go. But so when we think about it, what does it all mean for the macroeconomy? So one obvious thing is that if housing prices are falling, that has implications for dwelling investment and people's decisions about whether or not to build new properties. As you can imagine, the price that you would expect to get for a property that you build is a part of your business case. So we have for some time expected that the level of dwelling investment we have in the economy would stay at its current level. And the question was really, how long would that activity stay at that level before it came off? And what we've got here is, so if we start with the left-hand side, we have the residential pipeline. So this is basically the stock of buildings that have either been started or are about to start. So this is the number of in the higher density space, apartment blocks that people have got approval to do and they've either started or they're about to. The thing that's interesting about this cycle is how important higher density has been relative to detached housing. And that's particularly interesting in this case because it takes a lot longer to build a higher density property than it takes to build a detached house. So we've actually got a very high stock of work yet to be done. And so the question is, how long is that stock going to provide activity for all the people building stuff? And the answer is, well, maybe not as long as we might have thought, because on the right-hand side, we've got monthly approvals. So this is, you can think about this as the flow into the stock. So the number of houses that are getting added onto the stock of work yet to be done. So the rate at which people are building stuff is not changing. The stock is high, but the rate at which things are being added to that stock is going down. So that's quite consistent with a housing market where activity levels have come off. So another factor in the forecast and a part of the revision to the kind of further out forecast of the 2020-21 forecasts is that we've feel more confident about saying, yes, dwelling investment will turn. And it will probably turn quite sharply when it does, and that's now in our forecasts. So that's something that we've been talking about for a while, so it's not a surprise, but I think it does have an effect on the numbers ultimately. So that's one macroeconomic effect. Another macro or potential macroeconomic effect is on consumption. So here's my bonus graph. For those of you who have read all 75 pages of the Statement on Monetary Policy, you will know this graph is not in there. So this graph is going to come out as a part of a bulletin article on consumption and wealth effects in the March bulletin, so stay tuned. That's the teaser. So I did not do this work myself. But there is this question about, well, to what extent does a fall in housing prices affect people's decisions about their consumption? So this graph has a lot of information on it. So if we just focus on the dots, that gives you the change in consumption that you would expect for a 1% increase in housing wealth. And so the point of this graph is that if wealth goes up, you're most likely to increase your consumption of some goods, in particular durable goods. So on the left-hand side, we basically have cars. And then as we go down the list, there's a whole range of things like furnishing and utilities that we would describe as consumer durables. And then by the time we get to the right-hand side, so things like alcohol and food, there's basically not much of a reaction at all. So these are kind of more your necessities. So one reason you would expect housing prices to be related to consumption is that when you buy a new house, you buy new furniture and you buy new household appliances and the like. So this is the turnover effect. And we think that that's probably going to be sitting underneath things like the fact there's a significant elasticity on furnishing. There's also a collateral effect. So if your house, I'm talking about this in terms of the positive because that's just easier in my head. The value of your house has increased, but the value of what you, or the borrowing that you've made to get that house hasn't, maybe you'll feel inclined to say, well, I could get a car loan, but I can actually use my housing loan to purchase the car. Although I would really hesitate, I make a big point here that households are actually injecting on aggregate, injecting equity into their houses at the moment. They're not withdrawing equity. So this was a very big feature of some people in the room were probably on a housing desk at this time. So in the early 2000s, there was quite a bit of discussion about the fact that households were withdrawing equity from their houses. So we think that that sort of behaviour is probably more related to things like vehicle sales. And then there's the other channel is just, well, if my wealth has gone up, my kind of lifetime budget constraint or my lifetime budget, my lifetime income has increased and therefore I can pick up my consumption. So we do think that there are wealth effects on consumption, but I think it is important to keep them in perspective and it is important to remember that income growth is probably a more important factor behind people's decisions. I think that raises another interesting point just briefly, that the fact that housing prices are falling in the current environment is quite unusual. So it's very unusual for housing prices to be falling and housing market activity to be falling in a situation where the unemployment rate is going down and mortgage interest rates are quite low. So usually the reason that you have these sort of cycles is, you know, if the unemployment rate's going up, suddenly I don't have an income, I can't service my mortgage, and that's sort of when I'm going to sell my house, for example. But actually we're in a situation where the unemployment rate is falling, employment growth is very, very strong. So those sort of servicing issues don't seem to be an important part of the story, or can't be. So just finally, on the effects of housing market dynamics, one of the, we're inflation targeting central bank, so obviously what happens in housing markets and how that affects some of the inputs into the CPI matters to us. So rent is a significant component of the CPI. And what you can see from this graph is that rent inflation has been very subdued, and that has contributed to the relatively low inflation numbers that we've seen. You can see that for places like Perth, where the housing cycle turned quite a lot earlier, rent inflation has been, well, rents have been falling for quite some time, and cumulatively that's quite a big number. And that's been a drag on the sort of overall rent number. What's particularly interesting now is that rents in Sydney seem to be falling. So this is, So rents are a price, so this is for the school students, supply and demand. So in the case of Sydney, demand in terms of population growth, for example, has held up. But what's happened is that we've got a huge amount of supply coming online. So there's a lot of apartments being built and a lot of apartments being completed. And you can think of rents in some ways as being a price that signals where the balance of supply and demand is. So it seems that at this point the rate at which supply is coming online is actually a bit faster than the rate of demand. So I don't want to overstate that. So the sort of rule of thumb kind of numbers is that, you know, is maybe the apartments coming online are kind of 1 to 2 years of demand. So this isn't sort of a process that will take 10 years to resolve. But it does raise risks and is an important thing for us to keep an eye on. So very final graph. I don't know how I'm going for time. This is, I guess, the summary graph for us, which is what do we think inflation is going to do? Sitting underneath this, we do have an increasing wage growth. So we think labour costs are going to increase. We think that they are going to get passed through to final prices over this period. Offsetting that to some extent, we have things like rent inflation looks like it's going to be pretty subdued. All the information that we have on administered prices and utilities prices suggests that they're going to be growing certainly in the near term by less than what they have been in the past, so that will be a drag on inflation. But we do expect, with the economy growing faster than potential, labour costs picking up, that inflation will continue to increase gradually, and we have it at 2.25% by the end of the forecast horizon, with all the appropriate caveats around uncertainty, as demonstrated by the fan chart. So I'll finish there and hand back to Stephen.
Right. Please thank Alex. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. There's one hand up already. So why don't we go to Rory first, and then please, when you ask a question, just state your name and affiliation, and we'll go from there. We'll go here. No, we haven't got a mic. So
just use your big voice.
As you said, the Reserve Bank's an inflation target and central bank, and you've got your feature chart at the end showing the trim mean inflation outlook. What you've got there is the trim mean moving up from 1.8% mm-hmm. over 2018. 2 or 3 years down the track, it's 2.1%. So it's a very slow further climb towards the midpoint, and maybe on that trajectory, 4 or 5 years down the track, we'll be back to the midpoint in the band. Governor Lowe said publicly about a year ago that there had been a push by junior staff for further rate cuts. You know, it's 2.5 years since the Reserve Bank cut rates. There was a bit of a push by the junior staff for rate cuts, some junior staff, he said. But he pushed back on that by saying that he had the broader responsibility of also managing financial stability. So he said that, you know, that you could push inflation up faster, but that would come at the cost of potentially excessive growth in housing credit and house prices. That argument seems to have collapsed with house prices, or at least with the downtrend in house prices. Is there a renewed push by you and other junior staff for rate cuts?
I'm not a junior staff member, Rory. I like to think I'm senior. You know, I think when Phil made that comment, a part of the point that I took away was he was trying to make it clear that there is debate within the institution, and I think it's true that if you were making a fervent argument for cutting rates in 2016, you probably would still be making those arguments, and there are definitely people within the building who are prepared to take that side of the argument. Now I've forgotten the question. So I think the fact that we've downgraded the forecasts and that Phil has changed or made it clear that there's a change in the balance of risks is really a reflection of your question. So I think for us it's a fairly continuous process of assessing the new information that comes in, making adjustments to the forecast when we think that's justified, and thinking about the risks and the balance of those risks, and I think it's been made fairly clear that both those things have changed.
Thank you. I'll go to Paul.
Paul Box from HSBC.
Yeah. Oh, I can see you.
Thanks for the presentation. That was great. Thorough exposition of the outlook and the forecast. I've read the statement in a fair bit of detail, and I think it was striking.
I'm sure you did.
A very large downward revision in the GDP forecasts, but barely any. In fact, almost there's no revision virtually to the employment forecasts. Now, a part of that, as you described, is history. It's what you're given, right? You've had this downward surprise, you've had these downward revisions that have pushed GDP lower, you've taken it out of consumption, and the employment numbers have actually surprised you to the upside.
Yeah, and but I would say, though, the employment history exists despite the revision to the consumption numbers.
But it's not all revision, because you have revised down your GDP forecast, but you have not revised down your employment forecast out to the end of this year. So I'm wondering partly whether this is a reflection of banks having less certainty about the way the GDP is put together, more faith in the employment numbers perhaps, or, and I guess the other part of it would be, how do you explain revising down consumption a bit, revising down dwelling investment, but not revising down employment? Does that mean the jobs, there are jobs coming from elsewhere that we should be thinking about that offset the weakness that comes from those? And maybe you could just step through that a bit more. Because I think it is, I mean, to put a couple of numbers, a number on it, to June 2019, you've gone from 3.2% GDP growth down to 2.4, which is a 0.8 percentage point revision.
And about
the employment numbers have actually gone up a bit. I mean, the employment growth is up from 2.2 to 2.3 year on year. So, you know, employment is actually a little bit stronger.
Yep. So I think in the near term, so there's sort of two pieces to that question. There's like what have we done in the near term and what have we done in the longer term or the medium term. So I think in the near term, it's probably fair to say that there's a bit of a discrepancy at the moment between what the labour market numbers are telling us and what the activity numbers are telling us. So there is a bit of a process of weighing those two things together and so this may show my personal biases, having spent so much time in my life working on the labour market, but I think we probably have a little bit more confidence in the general trend of the labour market. I think it's true that the revisions and the nature of the recent consumption data, for example, make us feel, it's just a bit harder to gauge the momentum, and I think we'll feel a lot more comfortable when we get a bit more information before really making a call on the activity numbers. So for the near term, I think our confidence around the labour market really is around the forward-looking indicators that we have. So the vacancies numbers, the hiring intentions numbers, so things like that. We also have the liaison program. So we go and talk to businesses and we ask them questions about what are you planning to do, et cetera, et cetera. And the vibe that we're getting from that is pretty similar to the hiring intentions. So I think we feel pretty confident about the next 6 months or so. And as you know, we're already, so the timing of when we get the data, that's quite old by now. So 6 months from now, we're pretty much halfway through 2019. So that, I think, resolves the 2019 story. The forecasts for employment growth have been revised down a little bit further out, not dramatically. I think that's fair. That really is around the revisions point. So the employment growth we've seen has been consistent with, consumption growth that was 0.2 percentage points lower than what we had thought it was. So, you know, the way you fit the pieces together suggests that, the revision based on the history is probably doesn't sort of necessitate a full revision to the employment numbers as a result. You don't look very convinced.
At the end of 19, there's still employment is year on year exactly the same.
And yeah, so, and I think
is year on year lower. To have for not the history, forecast down, but not the employment forecast down.
Yeah, so I think that is because we have information that we think takes us a long way through 2019 that gives us quite a bit of confidence about the labour market. Sorry?
We have just, I think there was one in the middle here. Sorry, did you want to say one more?
Yeah, no, you go. Yeah, that's a very good question. So the bottom line is, so for people who haven't read the Statement on Monetary Policy in quite the same detail as everyone else, one of the components of GDP that we actually do have a degree of confidence around is business investment. So that's got a mining investment component and a non-mining investment component. So on the mining side, actually, all the liaison that we're getting is that that's going to be more positive than what we had been forecasting for a while. On the non-mining investment side, the best leading indicators that we have come from things like the CapEx survey from the ABS, and they were actually revised up. The business confidence numbers did come off quite significantly, although I think the NAB numbers actually bounced a bit yesterday. And so for us, I guess, again, it's one of these signal-to-noise ratio problems. So the decline in confidence came about in a period of time when financial markets were moving quite a lot. There wasn't a lot of other news. Housing prices were falling. So there's a real question for us about whether it's businesses reacting to the atmospherics or is it businesses reacting to their own personal situation. And again, I guess we use the liaison program and the information that we get from that. So we talk to businesses about what they're going to do with what their hiring intentions are, but we also talk to them quite a bit about their investment intentions. And that's still, I mean, it's not even across all industries, so certainly some industries are more confident and are planning to do a lot more than other industries. So retail, for example, shows up in the NAB survey, for example, and our liaison as being an industry that's not quite as confident about the future as some others. But the general sense we get is that there's no sense of loss of momentum in business investment from what we're hearing. So again, could we be wrong? Absolutely. Is there uncertainty about the forecast? Absolutely. Do we pay attention to the surveys? Yes, but I think we would want to see much more of a run of declines in conditions, because conditions are actually about average. They're not below average if you take the survey seriously. Yeah. So the answer is we do pay attention to it. It is something that we are factoring in at this point. It hasn't been sufficient to outweigh the other information that we use.
We do have to keep moving, I'm afraid. Sorry. So maybe Alex might be around later.
I can be around later.
Maybe you can ask some questions of Alex later. Please, thanks. Thank Alex again.